This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.
Tom Kane, this is the voice of Yoda on Star Wars. And the Neverland podcast you are listening to. Yes.
Another world. Another time. In the age of wonder.
There was once a dream. You could only whisper it. Anything more than a whisper, and it would vanish.
A battle between good and evil.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Where shall I find a new adversary so close to my own level?
Try the local sewer.
You know of the rebellion against the Empire?
The Avengers, Earth's mightiest heroes.
Peace means having a bigger stick than the other guy.
One of these days, I'm going to have a stick of my own.
I'm Groot.
Welcome to the Neverland Podcast. The podcast for lovers of Disney, Pixar, Marvel, and Star Wars.
I'm glad you're here to tell us these things.
Please welcome your host, Jeremy.
I thought he'd be taller.
Yeah, I can fly.
All it takes is faith and trust.
Well, if it isn't the Star-Spangled Man with a plan, what is your plan today?
Up to Neverland!
Take your pixie out of your pockets, Neverlanders, and sprinkle some of that pixie dust around. Think up that happiest thought, and let's fly away to Neverland. And guess what? You're not alone. Of course, I'm not alone either, but I am your host, Jeremy the Spider-Pan. I'm a head last boy around here, and we have our head pixie here. Hello, Windy Nerd. We call you Heather.
Hi, yes.
Well, yeah, Heather, but we call you the Windy Nerd.
Heather's my real name. Windy Nerd is my... Yeah. Moniker for here, I guess.
Yeah, and if you hear noises in the background, that is because the adult cat has decided to wander in the studio, because if we leave her outside when Heather comes in, both of us in here, she can't handle that. So if you hear a noise in the background, that's the adult cat, which actually leads to a story of the adventure we're having now, which we might as well tell everybody, because I may have to deal with it here in the studio. Who knows? I don't know. It's getting complicated, but all right, this is your fault, so you better start.
My fault.
You found her.
Okay, so on Memorial Day weekend, I'm driving back from my parents' house, and I happen to see along the side of the road a teeny tiny little kitten, and I had to pull over like immediately because I knew it was going to get squished if it stays, you know, wandering on the side of the road. So
yeah, these were like country road, back road, so it wasn't out like on a major thoroughfare necessarily, yeah. But still.
Well, it's still that particular road was a major road going through. For this particular place. So anyway, it could have been squished like any moment. So I ran back and I grabbed the kitten, and since it was Memorial Day, there really wasn't anywhere to take her for as far as a shelter. So we took her to an emergency hospital because it was obvious when I picked her up that she needed some medical care.
Yeah, and you called me because she wouldn't, she was like climbing all over you, and she wasn't going to let you drive or something.
Yes, even though I had a box to put her in and had a little blanket, made a little bed for her, she did not want to stay in the box. She wanted to climb all over my car. So I couldn't drive.
So you called me, and so I was on my way to go do something, and I had to turn around and come back, and then you figured out a way to, you could put a lid on the box.
Fortunately, putting a lid on the box kind of quieted her down, so... Yeah. We could get her to the emergency room, and there was a lot of what do we do with the cat
before
we got to the point.
We have the adult cat, which is wandering around the room right now, and trying to introduce two cats is very, very complicated. Are you drinking my drink?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought it was mine.
I'm going to take a drink of my drink now.
So it's not like, you have it drank after each other before.
Yeah, and you know, we shouldn't be afraid of anybody else's spit by now.
Yeah, so
it's 16 years, which, by the way, so that weekend we hit 16 years of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I turned 42 on Sunday.
Oh, yo, fogey.
Yeah, and boy, my body feels it. But I was worried about trying to introduce this, and there was a stray cat a couple weeks ago that had showed up on our doorstep that decided it really liked me and tried to follow me into the apartment to where our cat came up and hissed at it. So I was like, okay, well, our cat doesn't like other cats. This is going to be bad. But then I meet this little kitten, and she just gives you this little meow. Help me.
She is so cute. She will capture your heart like right away. And
we end up in an emergency room for cats.
Our older cat, when we adopted her, had a history of like not being compatible with other cats. So yeah. This is why she ended up at the rescue for the second time.
Yeah. Well, I think it was the third time in, they said that, you know,
she
hadn't fit in at some couple homes. So our current cat, Alora, who's an adult, she's about how old now? Is she about?
She's going to be seven. She is.
I thought she was at
officially
least six.
A senior cat. So anyway, we brought her to the
but she's very happy with us.
Emergency vet. Yeah, Alora is happy. We don't want to upset that. Anyway, so the kitten had conjunctivitis, which is like cat pink eye, basically.
Yeah.
And then had a respiratory, some respiratory issues. Which
was from cat herpes.
Yeah.
Which apparently 85% of cats have, especially if they're strays. So we're pretty sure our adult cat has already had it because she was a rescued stray.
Yeah. She was like, I guess she was rescued because she had kittens on somebody's porch. So was the story that we were told when we got her. Anyway.
And we were hoping, though, because she's had kittens, that she's going to look at this kitten and be like, oh, look, it's a kitten. That didn't happen.
Well, there's a difference between your kitten and other kittens. And all the time growing up, like, we had kittens and things like that. We only once do I ever remember another cat caring for a cat's kittens. Like, the mothers helped each other out. Usually they took care of their own kittens and had nothing to do with each other. So, anyway, so we have been, I have been, not we, I have been, trying to get pills and eye drops and feeding and cleaning up poop all week long. Took her to school.
Yeah, we've had to keep her locked in the bathroom because we got to keep the cat separate for a slow introduction. And
health
eventually,
reasons.
Or health reasons. Plus, you need to get the scent of one cat and share it with the other. So we need to get stuff, you know, like the kitten has pretty much been climbing on us. And she is, a moment is wasted if she's not being held close to your
chest.
She's
got to be snuggled like
she's got to be snuggled all the time. So I have plenty of shirts with kitten scent. Now, that'll mix with mine, which apparently if we have the adult cat smell that enough, that will slowly kind of help work things in there.
And we also have, because when we took her to the vet for her kind of 1 week, I guess it was actually 5 days, kind of checkup to make sure that the eye infection was clearing up properly. That cage is sitting in the living room, so the cat sniffed that. I got a little tub that I had to give the kitten a bath because she's, I guess, would be 5 weeks. 5 weeks old now.
Yeah, 5 weeks old.
But has,
so she wasn't even supposed to leave her mother yet.
No. She doesn't.
So you're mommy now. This cat totally has taken you as a mommy.
Yeah, I am. I think there is a difference when I walk in the room versus somebody else. Now, she likes other people, and she hasn't rejected anybody or been scared of anybody. But I think there is a difference when I get there. Anyway, so I had to give her a bath because she's got a little diarrhea. We're hoping the dewormer will clear that up. And then maybe she will get to the litter box more often. I'm hoping because I'm getting tired of cleaning up kitty poop. She knows where the litter box is, but she doesn't always use it.
Well, I think, you know, because she's sick, you know, so poor kitten. She's just sick. But this is here's the funny part of this. So this kitten's been living in our bathroom is divided to where there's the sinks. There's two sinks and then another door that goes into where the toilet and the shower and the bathtub is. So I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning because I have to be at the radio station about 45 minutes away by five, before five really, because I have to start programming the music and putting some ads in for the 5 o'clock hour. So I get at like 3 o'clock in the morning, I gotta go in and I gotta use the bathroom. I gotta, you know, try to get a shower. And anytime you go in there, the kitten will wake up, even though you're trying to keep her asleep. And if you're there, then you need to be paying attention to her as her perspective. And so she'll follow around there, and she's gotten, the healthier she gets, the faster she gets. And she'll come loping around along, doop 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 doop, kind of funny, and mew! And if you're standing by the sink, she'll start climbing your leg. If you're sitting on the toilet and you didn't get that door closed, she will not settle down until you pick her up and you're holding her while you're trying to poop.
Or whatever else.
You know? So you have to try to get in there and close that door before she gets in there. But it's just so funny watching her loop doop 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 because she's fast at it, but she looks funny trying to run.
Well, she's not gotten strong enough yet to walk on her toes like a proper cat, so she's
She's
kind of rabbiting it a little bit, so not fully flat foot, but it's just kind of at an angle, so she looks a little awkward when she runs. But yeah, she's got this funny hop gallop kind of thing going on.
Yep. It's pretty funny. But yeah, so now I almost dread, like, oh man, I got to go to the bathroom. I was going to wake the kitty up, and I'm going to have to end up hanging out in the bathroom with the kitten for a little while, which we don't mind hanging out with the kitten, but it's like we're in the bathroom. You know?
Yeah.
Although we have tried to bring her out and sit with her on the couch now, although the adult cat is still not entirely happy. The thing is the adult cat, Allura, is aware that there is a kitten in the place.
Oh yeah, she knows.
She, first day, she kind of came and guarded the door a little bit, but now she just, when we go in and out of the bathroom, Allura will get up in her tree and pout. She just has sometimes that kitty look of pouting, like, you're in there with another cat. I don't like this other cat. Oh, but it is funny with the, when I got into the toilet, whenever I get in there to the toilet and I get the door closed, I have little kitten paws that'll come underneath the door.
Yeah. Well, and another time she'll lean, I swear, she leaned down to meow underneath the crack in the door because you could hear a muffled meow meow, then all of a sudden it got really loud. So she had to have bent down, put her mouth to that crack and meowed to the crack.
Yeah. And she'll go a prolonged, almost a howl in there. Just meow.
She's got these multiple meows, although the panicky meow of, like, insecurity, I think, has been pretty much gone. She's just got this little beggy meow now.
Yeah.
So I think she feels like she's safe, which is good because I don't know what she went through before she was out on the road. We don't know if she was dumped or if she was abandoned. I don't know. She wasn't in a bad shape. Like, she didn't have lots of fleas. I think I did find a couple of ticks on her. But she was actually, as far as, like, signs of her being out in the wild and, like, with ticks and fleas and everything coming on her, she was in pretty good shape in that aspect. So she hadn't been out there for very long, which makes me think she was maybe dumped.
Yeah, somebody abandoned a 4-week-old kitten out there.
Yeah. She's a calico. She's a cute, pretty little kitty.
And her eyes are a lot better. I've been putting photos up on my Instagram. You know what? I should memorize what my Instagram is so I can share it. I will try to get a link up in the show notes or up on our, we have a Facebook page and also a Facebook group. I'll try to maybe share some of the photos there, but also onto our, I've been posting stuff up to Instagram. You got a bunch of photos you've taken that I haven't posted up because you haven't sent them to me yet or anything. So this is going to be an ongoing kind of saga for us. We're going to wind up being a 2-cat household unless we cannot get the adult cat to accept the kitten. Although it seems like the adult cat just is avoiding. She's not swatty with the kitten. So I have some hope that this could work. Because what I was worried about is our cat beating up the kitten or something.
Yeah, I most cats don't do that. Like, she may swat her, like, swat, 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 get away. But there's not, like, a death confrontation.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about. I don't know what Allura's capable of, you know?
No, I don't want Allura to go backwards because it's taken her a long time to progress forward to being as comfortable with us, because she's a very standoffish cat and is very, has some peculiarities as far as, like, when she likes to be petted, how does she like to be petted, you know.
That's kind of a cat thing anyway.
She's quirkier than any cat I've ever owned, and so I don't want her to go backwards and to be so, like, aloof and, you know, like, feel like she's being abandoned because we have a kitten.
She's rubbing her scent all over this room here. This was going to be my neutral space in here as best as I could try to have the two cats meet more in here, because it says a neutral space would be good, but really there's not much neutral space in this little apartment.
No.
So this is going to be interesting. But to make another kind of funny story, about the same time that we end up with this kitten, there's this guy, Chris, that I work with. He's kind of the guy over my head at the radio station. He, every Friday, brings in this lovable little pit bull named Layla that she just loves everybody. See, if you raise a pit bull, right, they're lovable little fun dogs. and they love to play. There's a lot of energy, so you got to be able to play with them. And she thinks anytime we're not playing with her, it's just the most depressing time. You can just she'll lay there, just like, nobody's playing with me. Everybody's busy working.
What else do you have to do but play with me?
But I had mentioned that I thought, you know, because Heather's been taking the kitten with her to work at school and passing around the students, so that way somebody's holding the kitten at all times. And I had thought, it's like, you know, about bringing the kitten with me to work one day, like on Friday, because of, you know, the dog always is there on Friday. I thought, well, maybe I'll bring the kitten along. But I talked to Chris and said, I don't know if Layla would play with the kitten or eat the kitten. And he looks at me and says, you know what? Layla actually has adopted a kitten that was a stray just over the weekend. Somehow or other, this kitten just had wandered into the garage or whatever. And Layla, the pit bull, started playing. And they're playing hide and seek, apparently, around there, where the kitten will go and hide and then pop out at the dog. And the dog just thinks it's fun. And he tried to take his dog somewhere. And the dog goes to the back of his car and is crying out the window because they left the kitten behind. So now he has a kitten because the dog adopted a kitten.
That reminds me of the Looney Tunes with the bulldog and the little kitten.
Yes, it's exactly like that. So we've had some kitten hijinks around here. And Eric is not here once again this week because I believe he has completed moving. He was supposed to be out by the end of May. But he is off helping Adrian Ropp at the Denver Con. So if you happen to be in the Colorado area, I hope you were there and you saw their booth and you got some artwork from Adrian Ropp. So Eric will hopefully maybe be back next week and we'll be back to some sort of normalcy. So that's where that is. But until then, Heather is here today. We got to talk about the elephant in the room real fast for what's going on in the Disneyverse. Oh, but one other thing I want to throw in. This is kind of interesting. So DJ Manco, who's one of our Lost Boys, sent a video to me. I know him as Court. I usually don't use people's last names. But yes, his first name is Court, like a courtroom. That's kind of cool. I met him at the Radio Talent Systems thing over the summer. He actually was doing a show at Northwest Missouri State University. I can't remember what it was called, but he was doing a show there. I think he's graduated now, and so I don't know what he's up to now. But he sent me a video from there's a YouTube channel called Defunct Land, and the people who run Defunct Land, they do nice little documentary videos about old Disney attractions that aren't there or old theme parks, things like that. But he actually sent me a video. I did not know this, but Ray Kroc, and the look on your face says everything. Who's Ray Kroc?
Yeah, no kidding.
There is actually a movie about Ray Kroc with Michael Keaton. I forgot what it's called. The Founder, I think. I haven't watched it yet. Ray Kroc is the guy who bought the McDonald's franchise from the McDonald's brothers and turned it into the McDonald's fast food franchise that we know. Ray Kroc, back during the World War II, I guess it would be, yeah, would have been, no, well, World War One was, just like Walt Disney, too young to do anything, but wanted to do something, faked his age, and became an ambulance driver for the Red Cross. And actually, Ray Kroc and Walt Disney met at when they were training to be ambulance drivers in World War I. So that's interesting. But this video actually follows. So I didn't know that. But Ray Kroc, when he met the McDonald's brothers, and they were doing this idea of doing some quick service hamburgers, and Ray Kroc is the one who said, this could be a bigger franchise than just your little hamburger stand. And so he's the one that kind of made it into a full thing. And eventually he bought the whole thing from the brothers. But he knew he needed to do something to kind of advertise and make this idea bigger. And so he actually worked with Walt Disney. You know, or he contacted Walt Disney like, hey, remember me? You know, we were ambulance drivers. And wanted to get something going on with Disneyland when Disneyland was getting their promotion stuff in order to get like fast food things rolling. And so they kind of worked together. But that was like the beginning of where we'd have partnerships where you've had Disney toys and Happy Meals. And the contract's kind of been on and off through different things. Currently, we've got a contract where there are Disney and, of course, Marvel and Star Wars things popping up at McDonald's. But they've previously, you know, they've been over at Burger King and stuff like that. There's been all kinds of different things. But I found that to be very, very interesting. So if you go to Defunct Land, go look for that video. It's very interesting. I've also found he did a video about the Orient Express here at Worlds of Fun. And there are actually some people who were ride designers at Disneyland who eventually came and did some work at Worlds of Fun. But unfortunately, Cedar Fair has run that park into the ground because it's not a priority to them. They'd rather put all their money competing directly with Disney. Somebody please sell Worlds of Fun to Disney and let them build a decent park. Because Walt wanted to build a park in Missouri anyway. Why not here?
Wow, there's so many connections with Kansas City and Walt Disney. And it's in the middle of the, you know, middle of the country. You could have, you know, you've got your East Coast park, you've got your West Coast park. What about the, you know, the Midwest? Yeah, the
Midwest. So people around the middle of the country could maybe afford to visit more often. But the elephant in the room...
This will be a day long remembered. It has seen the end of Kenobi and will soon see the end of the rebellion.
Plug in. He should be able to interpret the entire Imperial network.
Welcome, young Skywalker. I have been expecting you.
Star Wars News.
Galaxy's Edge opened on the 31st, and there was a big gala event. You got to see some of the video. Yeah, some of it. But they had like a press event. Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford and Bob Iger was there, and George Lucas came out, and they had even some fun with firing up the engines on the Millennium Falcon. We had Chewie on board. A lot of different fun stuff. I mean, big event to open up Galaxy's Edge. But here are the things that I've picked up from watching some videos and reading some reviews. I did, the first thing I saw was a review from Dusty Sage of, I think it's Mice Chat. Yeah, Mice Chat. This was the only concerns I've seen so far on the Smuggler's Run is, you know, it's very, very cool. I've gotten to see the queue line you go through and you kind of wind back around and there's not really any source music in the area. No John Williams music, because it's supposed to be like you're really in there. So they're very light on putting those John Williams motifs into the area, from what I'm learning. But you go through this whole walkway. It's very realistic. Hondo is there to give you instructions. That animatronic is fantastic. But he was mentioning when you get onto the Millennium Falcon, and I don't know how many chambers they have set up, but you get to kind of mill around in the main area where the game board is and stuff like that. And you have like a color-coded card that says what your position is going to be. The cast members would just come and call your color out, and you might not necessarily hear them very well. He was thinking they maybe need to have some speakers or something where they could call, hey, what crew is up? Other things that he noted that would be are problematic is the controls. He was piloting first, and he said the controls were very, very touchy. And from other videos I've seen, people are having a hard time piloting. And they're crashing into stuff, but he had people, there were strangers in there on his crew that were yelling at him because he was crashing into stuff, and he found that very uncomfortable. And of course, when you get off the ride, you have cast members as characters saying, well, hey, you owe us money, you did very badly, you crashed the Millennium Falcon, that kind of thing. And he didn't like that part of the experience, and then he also mentions he got back on a later time and he went in as a gunner. Now, you would think, based upon the films, a gunner is going to go up and down the ladders to where these turrets are out on the ship. But no, you're in this mid position and you have a button that lights up and you just press the button whenever it says to you. But if you're trying to watch out the main viewport to watch what's happening, your body is twisted. And Dusty was saying that was very uncomfortable to sit like that trying to hit his button but also trying to watch what's going on. So there is that. I have seen that criticism of the ride, but it looks like some other videos, people are still having a lot of fun. The other thing I saw, I got to see some footage in Oga's Cantina, which David Collins is the voice of Oga. I found that out. So many of you will know him from Rebel Force Radio. He now has the soundtrack show, which I love that show. Talking about movie soundtracks. He does a lot of work with LucasArts and stuff like that, music composer. But so he's doing that. But also Rex is back as the DJ, and it's very fun. I've got to see some footage of him, and he'll play some familiar Cantina songs. But he's got kind of one arm up in the air, and he's kind of bopping up and down. So it's goofy. And it is still Paul Rubens as DJ Rex. Good. So he's still in there. But then I also got to see, you know, the merchandise is very expensive. I've heard something that you could get something to cost you a few thousand dollars, and it's probably costumes.
Wow.
The two things I've really gotten to look in on, and I think what you're paying for is not so much the merchandise, but the experience you have. For $100, and I was watching an LA Times, I think one of their reporters go through, and with tax it was like $107 and some change. That was the droid experience. And the droid experience, you get to go through, pick what type of droid you want to make. They give you some blueprint to make sure you grab every part. There's a conveyor belt that goes by, and you pick your parts of whatever colors that you want. And then you go to another station, and you actually have some power tools there because you have to assemble the droid. And they kind of help you out. And they have this almost ceremonic thing where you put your droid in a thing, and it powers it up. And the head will turn and beep, 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 beep at you and stuff. And then you get your remote that controls it, and then they'll box it up for you. So it's $100, which might be more than the droids. That's pretty close to like a remote control thing, depending upon what it'll do.
Yeah,
but you're paying for that experience.
Yeah.
to go in there and to have like a droid building in a workshop. So that's what it's like, a Build-A-Bear, but you're building a droid. So you're paying $100 mainly for that experience, and then you get a fun droid toy. I kind of want one. I must say they look like a lot of fun. Mm. So, but then the other one, what would get you is the $200 lightsaber. But it's the experience you're paying for. The lightsabers are neat, but the experience you have, I watched some video, and this is very, very similar, but this is also a bit of criticism. Universal, when I've seen video, you go in and you have a wand ceremony. You have, you know, at Ollivander's, where one, usually they'll get a kid, gets to go and go through, oh, nope, not quite that one. Well, wave this one, poof, something else pops. You know, they, the whole Harry Potter experience with a wand. But only one person in a group will get to do that. But a wand, I think, is a lot less expensive. But they just do the experience, you know, and one person. Now, so one thing that's great about the lightsaber thing is everybody gets to have that experience. You're going into like a secret back room mm-hmm. of the shop. And they'll say, oh, well, do you have an appointment with a particular person? I forgot, it's like Savvy or something, the junk shop. But then you get this case and you got these different parts. And they go through the grade of how important it is for the selection of the kyber crystal that powers the lightsaber. And the colors and the meaning of the colors that you choose. Yeah. This whole thing. And then you choose your hilt types and your different pieces. And then after you've assembled your lightsaber, however you want it to look, they have you insert it into a slot. And it doesn't have any sort of blade thing on it. But you put it in there, and you hear Frank Oz as Yoda.
Nice.
Who the spirit of Yoda comes in, and the Yoda theme starts playing, and he's, you know, telling you how you must with the Force and all this stuff. You know, this neat little thing. And then, while you've got your lightsaber in the slot, it gets the blade part assembled, and... So it'll become, your spot where you put your lightsaber will light up, and you would pull your lightsaber out and extend it. And how this is working is it's like the light itself on the inside of this tube will extend and retract with sound effects. So I don't know how sturdy these are. I don't know if you were part of Saber Guild, if you'd want to use these. It's just kind of this neat lightsaber that you kind of got to put together yourself. But you spent $200 on that experience to go... to this big, yes, what will you do? The Force is your ally, that kind of thing. Because you can choose to make a red one, because the red, you know, people who choose red are after power. They crave power, you know, so welcome to the dark side. Yeah, that sort of thing.
I think there's some other colors that lean towards the dark side too, like orange. I think orange is a dark side one.
Well, I don't, well, they might have that on the Force Unleashed game, but mainly it's red.
I know, but I was looking at the colors at one point in time, and it was some neutral ones where, like, they're not...
The only ones available right now.
I don't know what all they have.
At Galaxy's Edge, you can do blue, green, violet. I thought it would be purple, but they're calling it violet or red.
Okay, well, so that's all right.
But that is, you know, you're it's expensive, but you're really paying for a one-of-a-kind experience, and for a Star Wars fan, that would be fun for the experience, but... Holy cow, $200 for your lightsaber. That's if you think about it of just buying it, then it's going to be a lot. But if you're thinking about the experience you're having with crafting it and this little, you know, Jedi ceremony you get to attend to, that would make it worth it.
I mean, there are some lightsabers you can purchase that's $200. I mean, like...
Yeah, you can buy
$200 on a lightsaber.
You can.
Easy, yeah.
So if you're thinking about the price of it, just think about you're having an experience. And that would be totally worth it.
Mama, now the gator got in the house.
Now the gator? Give me that shovel. Come here.
Get him, Mama. Get that gator.
The Neverland Trailer Park.
Sorry, I didn't get a chance to walk her. Oh, bad dragon. Back to your lair.
Come, dear brother.
our destiny awaits.
Okay, I'm coming.
I see you've brought sustenance for our adventure.
No, it's garbage for the trash can, and you left the lid off. Oh, shoot. Get out of here.
Shoot, get out.
Ugh, unicorns.
Quest.
It's not a quest. It's just a really fast and strange errand.
It's totally a quest.
So first thing in the trailer park, and somehow or another, I know I'd heard something of this, but I guess I wasn't paying attention and had no idea this was coming, but Pixar's next film after Toy Story 4, which, so this is either going to be coming over next summer, I guess, but Onward.
It was cute. It was cute. I kind of like the little take on, you know, the magical world that kind of looks a lot like ours.
Yeah, where, you know, time has gone forward a little bit, and the magical world has modernized. Very Harry Potter-ish, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But everything magical has not stayed separate from the regular world, you know. But I didn't see any humans, so the humans probably don't exist. Everything is look like elves, trolls. Some dwarves, gnomes, unicorns, mermaids, dragons for pets.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that there's a troll who's working the toll bridge, so it's a troll bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, just a lot of goofy, clever things. Even a lawn gnome who's just standing there and another gnome comes out of the house. Get back to work!
Yeah.
Quit standing around! So just silly stuff and the unicorns getting into the trash cans.
Like they're pests rather than like the noble unicorn.
They're all dirty and, you know, like raccoons. So just silly fun. And plus, you know, Tom Holland, which I give or take, whatever. And he's okay as a Spider-Man, but whatever. But Chris Pratt playing the brother, his older brother, who's off on a quest.
Yeah.
I'm sold. That would make it just fun. So I'm looking forward to what more we learn about this film, and I'll have to do a little bit of investigating, see what details Pixar has released about this one. But it looks like it's going to be fun, but it's Pixar. So far, there hasn't been a Pixar film that I didn't like. Even if I don't like it as much as some of the other ones, I still like them all. Pixar just makes good movies to me. So, yep. She's kind of side to side.
I don't know. There's some that I don't really care to watch again, just because they're a little, I don't know.
Make you cry too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Up. I mean, the first bit of it is like great, but then for the rest of it, I'm kind of like, oh, okay. So I don't know.
It's still a good movie. It's just the first 10 minutes is better than the rest of the movie.
Yes,
but the
is.
Rest of the movie is still pretty good. Yeah. It's got some good stuff. I am Doug, and I like you already.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. There's good characters in that movie.
Well, yes, there's. So, yes.
It's still a pretty good movie. So, oh, but we got another thing to talk about in the trailer park, but this one is not a movie.
No one.
All right, so I was already excited. I just a teaser. I just needed to be like, woohoo! Really, Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. I was already like, it's more Dark Crystal.
We've been waiting for Dark Crystal for a long time.
Yeah, so now we get our peek at it, and it's the perfect blend of a bit of CG and some of the modern film tricks mixed with classic puppeteering.
It's good. Like I like to getting to look at some other Gelflings. Like, you know, in the first one, we only see the two, but you don't get to see the variety of what could be, like, Gelfling kind. This one, you kind of get a little more of a picture of, like, what the Gelflings were like.
Yeah, because in the film, you've got a Gelfling who's raised by the Mystics, and he kind of behaves and dresses like one of the Mystics. And you got the other one raised by the little Podlings, and she dresses and behaves like one of them. Now we get to see what the Gelfling civilization was like, and what they would wear as Gelflings and, like, their armor and their ways. So that's pretty exciting. And this looks like, from what it looked like, it's going to be beginning at the crystal being broken.
Yeah, like the things that...
like darkness is just about to happen.
Yeah.
And the Skeksis are going to do something horrible.
Which, it gives me mixed feelings about it because...
A little depressing that you know that's not going to end well.
Yes, I know it's not going to end well because I know how the Dark Crystal begins. But I want to see all of the magic of the land, like what it was before. So it's almost like, even though we know it's going to end kind of poorly, but it's almost like we get a picture of what the world can be after the Dark Crystal, you know, and Kira and I forget his name.
Jen.
Yeah. You know, have kind of restored it.
There are comic books out of that.
You know,
comic books
I haven't read the comic books.
I haven't gotten to read them all either. They tried to adapt that story that they were going to make a sequel at one point. Mm-hmm. They've adapted that story into a comic book, which unfortunately I didn't get to read of. There were some follow-up comics I've got a couple of. But the comics, just seeing it drawn like that is not as good as the puppets.
There's something about it coming to life.
Yeah.
And breathing and living, you know, as much as it can on a screen. You
yeah.
know?
Oh, but we're just excited. So that is coming very, very soon on Netflix. And hooray. Jim Henson, I think, is going to be would have been very proud of what they've done. And at least that's from what I've seen.
There'll be spectacle, there'll be fantasy, there'll be derring do and stuff like you would never see.
Hey,
yeah, we're gonna be a movie
starring everybody
and me.
Boy, I wish I were you people seeing this for the first time.
Herman, I got a great picture of the chicken.
Oh, good.
All right, I know I'm a little bit late on this one because the movie came out a week ago, but because it was my birthday and our anniversary and Memorial Day, I wanted to take a week off, so we got to hear from Mick Foley at Planet Comic Con, and I hope y'all enjoyed that last week. But so now we're going to take a time to discuss the live-action version of Disney's Aladdin, and I did find a press kit on this one and found some interesting facts about the making of the film. Principal photography on Aladdin took place on practical stages at Long Cross Studios and Arborfield Studios, both in the UK, as well as the Hashemite Kingdom of Southern Jordan. So, yes, filming on location.
That's nice. Yeah.
The production filmed on the stunning desert vistas of Wadi Rum at Wadi Disi in Jordan. I'm probably getting those wrong. Where Lawrence of Arabia was shot, which I've never seen, but I know it's a big deal. The Royal Film Commission provided invaluable support to the production during filming, including comprehensive production services, assistance in facilitating logistics with local authorities, securing film permits, and hiring of 150 locals to supplement the existing UK crew.
Production designer Gemma Jackson, who won an Emmy Award for her production design work on Game of Thrones, was tasked with bringing Agrabah to life. She envisioned the city as a gateway to the Eastern world with a vibrant array of colors, cultures, and sounds. Her inspirations came primarily from Moroccan, Persian, and Turkish architecture and featured elements of Arab, Indian, and South Asian cultures. Since Agrabah is an Arab country on the Silk Road where cultural influences from other cultures in the regions could be found.
Yeah, and I did see some of that influence because they were coastal and you had like other dignitaries that would come in. That's makes sense. The art department, under the supervision of Gemma Jackson, built the massive Agrabah set outdoors on a tarmac the size of two football fields at Long Cross Studios in just 15 weeks. Set decoration for Agrabah included fabrics, textiles, and carvings similar to those found in Marrakesh, lots of colorful woods, metals, fruits, and vegetables, and a 1,000-year-old olive tree.
Oh, nice.
The Agrabah courtyard, market stalls, narrow alleys, and cluttered rooftops were designed to accommodate the extensive choreography and stunts featured in the musical numbers One Jump Ahead and Prince Ali.
The Prince Ali musical sequence is the biggest production number in the film, with 250 dancers and 200 extras. Costume designer Michael Wilkinson and his team created more than 200 costumes from scratch just for the extras. The 30-foot yellow flower camel on which Prince Ali arrives at the palace was made from 37,000 flower heads and took 15 model makers 3 weeks to build.
And previously, in another part of the press kit, it mentioned it took them like a week to shoot that sequence.
I bet so.
Wow. The director of photography, Alan Stewart, had 7 cameras filming the lavish production number Prince Ali to capture all aspects of the parade. For the One Jump Ahead sequence, he attached a GoPro camera to Mina Massads, who played Aladdin, attached it to his waist to capture footage from Aladdin's point of view as he runs and jumps through the narrow alleys and rooftops.
The VFX team created 40 minutes of
animatics.
Animatics, okay, and previs for the Prince Ali.
Previs. Animatics and previs. That's okay. So, since you don't know, and I bet a lot of other people don't know, that's where they'll kind of, and they'll do a lot now in computer, they will visualize what the scene's going to look like, and they'll animate the characters in a scene to kind of have a coordinate of what it's going to look based off the storyboard. There's actually some really fun behind the scenes of Return of the Jedi where they used some toys to, when they were doing the animatics for the chase there on the speeder bikes. There's some really fun footage on some making stuff. But yeah, they'll try to pre-visualize and shoot with miniatures, but now they do it on a computer so you get an idea of what you want it to look like before you actually start the main cameras rolling. So that's animatics and previs. But anyways, go ahead.
But yeah, so it took 40 minutes of animatics and previs for the Prince Ali musical number to give filmmakers a better idea as to the extent of the choreography that would be taking place, just like you were saying.
Yeah.
Jasmine's bedroom in the palace reflects the intelligence and strength of her character. Set decorations include books, maps, and opulent tapestries. Opulent tapestries and pieces of art collected by the princess. In the bed in Jasmine's room was doubled in size to accommodate both the princess and her tiger Raja. The accompanying bedspread was hand embroidered in Pakistan in honor Jasmine's late mother. Mother's Kingdom of Sherabad.
Sherabad, yeah.
Which is based in South Asia.
So I wonder if that's actually a real place.
Maybe
an ancient place.
Yeah.
The Cave of Wonders was created via a combination of practical sets and visual effects work, VFX. Mm-hmm. The cavernous interiors were built on sound stages at Long Cross Studios and included an enormous lion's head at the cave's entrance and artificial rock formations covered with jewels and miscellaneous treasures and voiced by Frank Welker. Woohoo. Set decorator Tina Jones sourced jewels from across the regions as they were quite colorful, sparkling, and bright. Some were recast in rubber and placed on the floor of the cave so the cast and crew could walk comfortably.
Almost every type of VFX work was utilized on Aladdin, including character animation, performance capture, set extensions, digital environments, and FX simulations. Visual effects supervisor Chaz Garrett built a 6-axis hydraulic platform for use in the flying carpet sequence A Whole New World. The rig on which Mena Massad and Naomi Scott sat was controlled by a hand-operated input device, which moved hundreds of metallic pins up and down and from side to side against a blue screen with pre-filmed backgrounds.
Aladdin's sidekick, Abu, while entirely digital, was based on a capuchin monkey, as if that wasn't obvious. Makeup and hair designer Christine Blundell created the wig, beard, and mustache worn by Naveed Negabon as the Sultan. The separate pieces, which were colored to match his natural color, were meshed with his real hair. The entire process took 45 minutes daily. Thankfully, the Sultan doesn't have a whole lot of scenes, but he's got plenty of them.
So let me jump in here because the biologist and me just grabbed capuchin monkey. Capuchin monkeys are from South America.
Well, but that would have been a problem with the original cartoon as well, because he is like a capuchin monkey, you can kind of tell. But the cast, of course, included Will Smith as a mariner / genie, which they kind of gave it away a little bit at the beginning. We kind of knew who that was.
Just go with it.
And then Aladdin, of course, we mentioned Mina Masood, I don't know if I'm saying his name right, Jasmine, it was Naomi Scott, Jafar, Marwen Kenzari, Sultan David Negabon, and Dahlia, a character, it was a new character, Nassim Pedrad, but she was kind of, was a good comic relief. She
was a good add-in.
She was a very good add-in. She could have been really bad, like Jane Foster's little annoying friend in the Thor movies that you, But thankfully, Dahlia was much better than that.
Yeah.
And added some nice little extra stuff in there and some extra story. Overall, most of the cast, I think, was pretty good. Jafar, there's people who've been critical of Jafar. I actually kind of liked him as Jafar. He was just enough sinister, I think, that fit. You know, he was very different from the animated, but...
I wanted more beard, more goatee.
Maybe, yeah, a little bit more beard on him. Maybe, you know, he could have been a little cheesy, though, if he was doing a little bit of goatee pulling. But he played it well. He was nasty.
Yeah.
I mean, so I actually don't have any real criticisms of him.
No, I don't know.
I really like Naomi Scott as Jasmine. In fact, she was the only one I think really... I mean, others could carry a tune, but there's a difference between carrying a tune and being able to sing your guts out. Mm-hmm. She is a really good singer. Because Mina Masood, he is okay, and Will Smith, he's a rapper. He, you know, him singing is kind of negligible. And Dahlia loved her; she was just great. She was so funny. She was actually probably the highlight. She was the real funny part of the movie. Because Will Smith, I'm sorry, he just wasn't very funny. He was great at the heartfelt, good, serious genie moments.
Yes.
But when he should have come up and been funny, to me it fell flat. And the Friend Like Me sequence was dull. This movie didn't really hit its stride until the Prince Ali sequence, and you could tell, and with 5 days and, you know, spending shooting and all the love and care they put into it, that part got me all into it.
The first part felt kind of rushed.
Boy, did it!
Like we're rushing through Aladdin's life on the street. We're rushing through even Aladdin and Jasmine's meeting felt rushed.
It got slammed right into the beginning of the movie.
We
didn't develop any characters. It's like they figured, oh, well, you've seen the movie. Let's just skip the scenes from the movie and we'll just tell a couple of in-between scenes and then we'll kind of pick up where the movie picks up, maybe at the Cave of Wonders. So you've got an entire sequence where Aladdin's first running from the guards is actually him running with Jasmine now. Mm-hmm. And parts of that song don't make sense anymore.
Yeah.
Because he's talking while he's riding in a cart with Jasmine. He's like, I think I'll take a stroll around the block. I'm like, no, you're not. You're driving a cart. In the original animated one, every bit, every line of that fits with what Aladdin is doing. It's talking about, you know, next time got to use a non-de-plume because he's posing behind a guy and then whoops, it goes wrong. He says that once again on this horse and cart makes no sense. They destroyed that entire sequence. They barely even got to hit with Jasmine with her trying to oop feed some kids. But it came across that she's even dumber than, you know, because like, don't you know you have to pay people for this stuff, right? You know. Because it seems like she just doesn't think about it in the cartoon. This one, I don't know, she felt dumb. Like, she should know.
Well, should have known. I mean, really, in the animated one, she should have known. The only thing I can think of is, as a princess, you don't ever have to pay for anything. Do whatever you want.
That seems to have been the first time she's ever gone out. In the movie, they talk about that, you know, she's done this before.
I didn't catch that part.
Yeah. That she sneaks out every once in a while because she feels very trapped. The part with her character that I like that fit is adding into her father being a little overprotective because having her mother die and her keeping her confined a bit too much. That kind of fit with the character.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of like that. They had to, of course, push. It feels like an appeasement when they do it, but it works because I've been seeing people absolutely loving the Speechless song, which it was a pretty good song. But adding that extra element of Jafar telling her that you need to be seen and not heard. And so when Jafar says it once again, as he's made himself as Sultan, it launches this song, which it's almost more of like a very, very feminist statement because every bit of line, she looks at some man and he bursts into dust. So every man has been eliminated now because I'm rising up to power. Mm-hmm. That has a message in it that I didn't appreciate. No. That's not inequality. That is dominance. And here's the thing. I can talk about two characters and say the exact same thing. They feel like they've been pushed aside. They want to become Sultan. Two characters have the exact same plot points. One of them being Jasmine, the other being Jafar. So to me, she was equal to Jafar. The difference is he wanted to go and invade like her mother's country. He was lusting for power. She had a bit more noble because she wanted to be able to help the people. But I was sitting there going, you're going to become queen of Agrabah. You don't think you're going to be able to help the people as queen?
Maybe it's a... Maybe
that didn't work.
The only thing I think of is it might be a touchback to the cultural, you know, of the time where women would have...
Yeah.
You don't get to speak unless you're spoken to by a man. And that's just the culture of what that was. That would be my only thing that I would apply to it. And that may be what they were trying
but
to
But it
go
would have
for.
Been shown a lot more in extreme levels than what... Because Jasmine had a lot of freedom compared to what maybe would have been at the time.
Yes.
She wouldn't have had even the freedom of what you would see.
I think...
So this being more of an animated, it's a little bit lighter. She doesn't seem to be that oppressed other than she's being very, very sheltered.
Yeah.
And then being told, that, well, you know, by Jafar, and not going to be allowed to be Sultan, I would be like... You're going to become queen, and Aladdin's definitely going to be listening to her for advice, because he doesn't know, if he becomes Sultan, he's not got a clue, you know. That's even something that comes up in the animated person, is like, oh, well, they want to make me Sultan. No, they want to make Prince Ali Sultan. And that's why he has that self-confidence issues, because like, I, you know, other than, I'm going to have to get into something else on this too, but he doesn't know how to be Sultan. He didn't really want that anyway, which I'm glad they carried over, and they do have a nice little conversation on the whole new world, you know, right afterward, where he's like, well, no, I totally value what you've got to say, because he didn't have a clue.
Well,
so of course he's going to value what she says on it, because she should know more.
I couldn't help but think when they had that discussion of the Sultan, is because I have read Arabian Nights, which is where the story originally comes from, and it is very different than the original source. But if you read Arabian Nights, they often refer to sultanesses. So as if there is a ruler that's a female ruler that is a sultaness. Now, I don't know if that's their name for the queen, or what is someone that maybe knows more of that may be able to explain that to me. But I couldn't help but think of that. Well, why can't you be sultan? You know, like, because I'm reading, you know, I'm remembering the source material and others are sultaness. So what's wrong with that?
Completely work, because I'm like, she's gonna be in power already.
It really did come off as we have to do a feminist move because of what's going on with the times in the movies right now. We have to have women power and all this, and I'm fine with a strong female.
They define what that actually means,
but at the same time, I don't necessarily need her to be like. I don't necessarily need her to be the end-all hero. She doesn't have to be all things. Nobody is all things. Yeah. Anyway, so that I guess that's just my little throw-in. It came off to me as, like, we have to throw this in because we have to win points with the other. The song
it was an appeasement,
like, the
but
song,
it was a good song.
The song by itself... And maybe if it was in a different part, or maybe like if they had an echo to it from before and then came back, like if
she had a previous song though about the issue.
I guess I wish it was built up a little more than what it was in order to really feel more in place there. Now I know we have Jafar telling her, or you know, they're saying things about being
seen,
quiet
yeah,
and seeing
seen
and
not
heard. If maybe we heard that echoed more in, like, we spent more time in the streets and we saw maybe some of that. Maybe there was more of the environment around reinforced that was what the culture was, and then she comes out and say it might have been more impactful.
Maybe.
But it just kind of seemed really for me to come out of nowhere. We know that we heard it said, but we didn't build enough time up to really, I didn't think for her to feel like, no, I am so fed up with being shut down and not heard and shelved. Now I'm going to come out. I think that's part of that rush stuff. They did spend a lot of times on the big, I guess I'm going to say Bollywood, because that's what it...
It was very Bollywood.
Which was fun.
It was fun
the
in a lot of ways. It did work.
Musical numbers, those seem like they took a lot of time on those, which is cool. That was some of the charm of Aladdin.
I got more to say though on that song before you get too far ahead.
But the... Now you interrupted me. But I felt like all of the other dialogue were just rushing to get to the musical numbers.
Yeah. But here's where that scene and her kind of dismantles part of this. Mm. Okay, so going back to the... this is a question I've had in the animated feature, and there's actually How It Should Have Ended. If you ever watch the How It Should Have Ended videos on YouTube, they point this out. If the genie grants you a wish and you are a prince... You are a prince. You're not in disguise as a prince. You are a prince. And even the How It Should Have Ended, they say, hey, the genie tells Aladdin, if I say you've got the strength of 10 men, you've got the strength of 10 men. Mm-hmm. So he is a prince, is how that should have been, but it was treated like a disguise. It kind of happens again in this movie. They create a country called Ababwa, and I thought it was kind of a clever way to use the Ali Ababwa, but if the genie says, you are the prince of Ababwa, if he's supposed to be all-powerful, Ababwa comes into existence, and that is now a real place, and every map should have shown it. They go through the movie, it's, oh, I don't find it on a map, and the genie has to do all this stuff, oh, like it's a big lie and a disguise. So, when Jafar gets his sultan wish, the only thing that makes him sultan is the genie just says, you are, let it be done. So it's so easy for Jasmine to sing her song and then talk to Hakim, which Hakim, I like the fact that they included him more because that is the character that Jim Cummings played in Aladdin. But it's so easy for her to say, why are you doing what he says? You know he's not the real Sultan. So the genie's first wish, even for Jafar, is garbage. The genie has no real power in those wishes. He can't make you a prince. He can't make you a sultan. He can say you are, and he can dress you like one and give you a big presentation, but it don't mean squat. So that still bothers me, because they made it worse. Because the animated, you can kind of get away with it as a cartoon. But this time, it's twice over because of the Jafar thing that went through.
Well, okay,
because so Jasmine just dismantled the whole wish.
Let me...
So, genie... Psh.
Let me pose, because he does say, and I do appreciate that they put it in, because I think it is something that maybe, I don't know, in the cartoon, we never thought about, or it just kind of got glazed over. Was that, you know, well, making you a prince, there's a lot of gray area in that.
Yeah, because, they threw a gray area to try to excuse some of it.
Well, but I think there that is a point. Like,
that was actually just something to bring up to beat the Jafar at the end.
We can make
anyway.
You look like one, you know, can't really change your you know, bloodline or whatever.
Yeah, you still are who you are on the inside. But if you're the prince of Ababwa, Ababwa exists and you are now the prince of it. That should be it. If you're an all-powerful genie, they should be able to make that happen. That's pathetic.
Okay, well, whatever.
There's no way to excuse that. If you are a prince, and if he's supposed to turn you into a prince, bang, you're a prince. So, this is why I give this movie it's worth watching once. I know some people have been super excited about it, but it's been getting like a 50-50. And it was entertaining, it has some good stuff, but Will Smith, I'm sorry, if he had been funnier, he should have been able to come in big boffo at a friend like me, and it just fell flat. And one thing that even, okay, so we know if you read the lyrics, it'll be bona fide and certified on that one particular line. Mm-hmm. Robin Williams played with it's a bona fide certified. Will Smith should have stuck with bona fide, because when he says bona fide, it becomes, oh, you're trying to be Robin Williams. Oh, you're not, and you're not as funny. Crash, burn. I was out.
Well, I felt that too. I don't know what the direction was on that, whether they wanted him to try to capture some of Robin Williams. You can't capture Robin Williams.
He needed to make it his own, and he almost did it so much his own that it was like Will Smith playing the genie, which is what I was afraid of when they cast him. I got exactly what I expected of him. He was just being Will Smith. But he, you know, Will Smith is likable.
Yes.
So, but I wanted him to be funnier, because we know he can be funny, but I don't know if the script was just didn't have anything for him. He was, because Robin Williams improvised a lot of his funny. Will Smith, yes. I don't think can improvise like that.
I don't think anybody can improvise like Robin Williams can.
Well, Tim Conway could. but
I think if they had maybe given Will Smith, I don't know, like this is just me surmising. If he had maybe taken it his own direction, they allowed him to make his own genie, you know, just keeping true to the character.
Which I felt like they did kind of. It did feel more of Will Smith than Robin Williams. He just wasn't funny. And we expected funny.
I actually like the serious tone. I like that, you know, if you see some of the things like on social media that's come out with Will Smith and his advice and things like that, I like that about Will Smith of him as a person.
Yeah.
And so I like that part in the movie, but the parts where they were trying to make him fit into Robin Williams' shoes, those were the parts for me that felt like I don't think you were very fair to Will Smith to try to live up to that.
Yeah, and at least write him some jokes that he could deliver in his own way to where he could have made it funny. They didn't give him really any good funny dialogue. So it was poorly written, so I don't know if it rides fully on his shoulders. I think it's just bad writing. Not to mention you've got Guy Ritchie's a director who directs things like a music video, and the beginning of the film was a music video. The way it rushed through, we didn't even get the busy, is he the humble thief or anything like that. The whole bits of the film, it was just sped up to catch up to where, oh, look, here's Jasmine now. And I even saw one critic saying, I'm sorry, I thought I went to go see Aladdin, not Jasmine the movie.
Well,
and it did feel that way sometimes. But I did like Jasmine in this movie. I liked that they gave her some more to do, but Aladdin just couldn't carry it on his own. And Will Smith, I mean, Robin Williams carried the original one. Will Smith, unfortunately, to me, could not carry this one.
Yeah.
Like Robin Williams carried the original.
But once again, you've got like Robin Williams is himself so much in... Okay, this is going to be...
Well, you're going to be repeating yourself, so should we cut this now?
This is going to be a very petty... I'm going to throw one thing in. I haven't mentioned this. This may be very petty, but I had a hard time believing Aladdin being a street rat. Because he was very clean.
Very clean, well-dressed.
His teeth are very white.
Yes.
Very, very clean.
That's not petty. That's a point.
To me, I had a hard time being like, how long have you been on the streets again?
Yeah.
So if they had, and I know they're trying to make him the handsome hero and all that kind of stuff, they still should have dirtied him up a little bit so that when he shows up as a prince, like there really is a big kind of like transformation kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's some other problems I had. Okay, an animated one, he's stealing bread. He's only trying to take food.
Yeah.
In this version, he's a jewel thief and whatever, and then he's trying to pawn stuff for money to get food.
Yeah.
So he's more of a thief in this one than he was... he felt more like a thief in this one compared to the animated. And by also altering the scene in the animated where you have the one prince who's a real jerk and he's going to whip some kids that ran out in front of him, and Aladdin has that confrontation, by not doing that, he's not confronting a prince. He's just some random guy who he kind of confronts. It doesn't make the prince who came in at that one point seem like such a jerk. He's just kind of a little bit dumb. This Norwegian guy didn't deserve to get fed to Raja the way he wasn't like fed to Raja, but he was just a little dumb, but he got kind of mistreated and didn't seem to deserve it like the guy in the animated one who was that jerk.
Well, and so this is where I think... So
that was another flaw.
They tried to be more cultural, I think, with this one, because it wouldn't have been the prince that talked to a peasant. That would not have culturally, like, that would not have happened. So one of the people that, because that's who it was. It wasn't the prince. It was one of their attendants, one of the guards, that said it. That would actually probably be more likely. But if you are trying to make an emulation of the cartoon... Should have had the prince actually deliver those lines,
because
even though it violated the cultural.
When we get introduced to that prince who's trying to come also in there, and apparently he's still staying in the palace when Aladdin shows up as Ali. So, but when he shows up, he doesn't seem like such a bad guy. He's just a little dim.
Yeah.
So he doesn't seem to be, you know, deserve to have Raja come up and bite his underwear, I guess, which was expected, you know, like that happened in the animated one. But that also fell a little flat because he was still a likable person, and Jasmine comes off a little bit, you know. She didn't look very good in that one to me. It's like, wow, you could have been a little nicer, even though you don't want to marry the guy. You could be polite. Even if he's dumb as a box of rocks, you could be polite.
Yeah.
So I know she didn't come off very good in that one. But overall, still, it's worth a watch. But I'm not buying it.
Was the Norwegian guy a stretch for Frozen?
I don't know. Maybe they're trying to create a live-action Frozen's coming. They'll pull it off one of these days.
They're going to try.
Unless somebody stops this. You know what? They're actually now working on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs of live-action. I am now sick of this, officially.
We've had lots of Snow White's live-action.
Well, and you know this is going to get rewritten because Snow White is not much of a personality in the original, but there's something classic and beautiful about that old classic one.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, when I saw the announcement of, here's our director for a live-action Snow White, I'm like, stop! Just stop already! I've had enough.
Well,
I've had enough of the remakes.
It would be nice for some.
Although I do want to see Lion King, because it looks good. but I'm about fed up. I've about had it after Aladdin. I've had it.
I would, honestly, and this is just for all the entertainment industry, can we please come up with something original?
Yes, like Pixar came up with Onward. That has a lot of original stuff. Go, Pixar!
Come up with something original, please.
Please, Disney.
We love all the old stuff, yes. We, you know, and we will always love it, but trying to recapture it in anything other than, like, we're just going to try to catch... It's like trying to catch lightning in a box.
Yeah.
So
instead of remaking
it,
why don't we just re-release them into theaters like they used to? Because even if you own it at home, you'd go for the experience.
We've gone to
saw Ghostbusters 30-year anniversary. We just watched Batman's anniversary.
Indiana Jones. We've seen Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom twice.
No, not Temple of Doom. Ranger of the Last Ark in the theater.
Yes.
People will go back. If you re-release the old classic movies and just put them into theater just for fun, people will go see them. You don't have to remake them. them. Just put the original in the, for the internet.
We love them as they are.
Yes, people love it. So, okay, but yeah, anyway, we can go on a rant. I need to turn a corner and go a little bit non-Disney for our next review.
To Disney and beyond.
Okay, so I've got to go a slightly non-Disney direction. Well, more than slightly. Because the other big film that opened this weekend was Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And I wanted to give a review for that one as well. And I have a little bit of information. So in 2014, Legendary Pictures announced that they had acquired the rights to Rodan, Mothra, and King Ghidorah from Toho to use in their MonsterVerse. Now, Legendary Pictures has, of course, mainly been working and releasing through Warner Brothers. They released that 2014 Godzilla movie, which we did review here years ago. You can go ahead and look that up. In the post-credit scene at the end of the 2017 film Kong Skull Island, Mothra appears in a series of cave paintings depicting other monsters that are known to exist that are shown in the footage of James Conrad and Mason Weaver, along with Godzilla, Rodan, and King Ghidorah. So that was the beginning of what is happening next in this film. Now I want to talk about some of the monsters you'll see in this movie, beginning, of course, with Rodan. As with Godzilla, writer Ken Kuranuma turned to prehistoric animals for inspiration in developing the character, though unlike the former, whose species is largely left ambiguous, Rodan is explicitly stated to be a kind of pteranodon. Just as Godzilla was conceived as a symbol of an American nuclear threat, Rodan was seen as an embodiment of the same danger originating from the Soviet Union. Rodan's debut appearance was the first and only time that the character was given a chestnut color. It originally had a menacing face with a jagged, toothed beak that would disappear in later incarnations as the character became more heroic. Rodan was portrayed via a combination of suitmation and wire-operated puppets for flight sequences. During suitmation sequences, Rodan was portrayed by Haruo Nakajima, who almost drowned when the wires holding the 150-pound suit above a water tank snapped. In Ghidorah, the three-headed monster, the Rodan suit was of visibly lesser quality than the previous one, having a more comical face, a thick neck, which barely concealed the shape of the performer's head within the triangular wings. The modification of the character's face was deliberate, as Rodan was meant to be a slapstick character rather than the tragic villain seen in its film debut. A new suit was constructed for Invasion of Astro Monster, which more closely resembled the first, having more rounded wings and a sleeker face. The sleek face was retained in Destroy All Monsters, though the wings and chest area were crudely designed. Rodan was revived in 1993's Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla 2, this time portrayed entirely via a wire-manipulated marionette and hand puppets, having received criticism for his emphasis on battle sequences relying heavily on beam weapons. Special effects artist Koichi Kawakita sought to make the confrontation between Godzilla and Rodan as physical as possible. So now let's move on and talk a little bit about Mothra. Now, Mothra has some various eras, and even in Godzilla films, there are various eras, and I don't know how they get the names for these eras. I'm not much into the, it might be a similar director or producer, I don't know. It was all Toho, but there's been different incarnations, and they kind of reset the characters every few years, generally, it seems. And we're currently in a newer version, and a more of an American version that's going on, although Japan did make another Godzilla film, which apparently was like a big deal. Like Shin Gojira, I think it was. I would like to actually see that one. I hear it is very, very good. But anyway, so we have the Showa era. That's from 1961 to 1968. And so Mothra. In the Showa continuity, Mothra is depicted as a mystical being that is worshipped by a primitive human culture native to Infant Island. Mothra has her hatching from an egg. This is a film called Mothra. But hatching from an egg after her priestess are abducted by a Rolissian capitalist hoping to exploit them as media celebrities. The larval Mothra swims to Tokyo and cocoons herself around the Tokyo Tower. Upon reaching her adult form, Mothra flies to Rolissa's capital and causes widespread destruction until her priestesses are returned to her. In Mothra vs. Godzilla, a Mothra egg appears on the coast of Japan and is exploited as a tourist attraction. Mothra's priestesses attempt to negotiate the return of the egg to Infant Island, but are rebuffed. Godzilla attacks Japan, forcing humanity to beseech an embittered Mothra to intervene. Mothra dies fighting Godzilla, but the latter is defeated when two larvae emerge from the egg and encase Godzilla in a cocoon. In Ghidorah, the three-headed monster, it is revealed that only one of the larvae survived. The remaining larva attempts to convince Godzilla and Rodan to join forces with her in order to fight King Ghidorah, but the two monsters reject her proposal. Mothra is nearly killed attempting to fight Ghidorah alone, but is saved through the intervention of Godzilla and Rodan. The larva ultimately gains adulthood in Ibira, Horror of the Deep, where she saves a group of slaves taken from Infant Island from a terrorist base on Lechi Island undergoing a self-destruct sequence. Another larva appears in Destroy All Monsters, living alongside other monsters in Monsterland. Along with all the other monsters, Mothra is briefly enslaved by the Kilax, who force her to attack Beijing and later join Godzilla in the destruction of Tokyo. The Kilax mind control is ultimately broken, and Mothra joins the other monsters in the final battle against King Ghidorah. Now we go to the Heisei era, or Heisei. This is from 1992 to 1998. You have Godzilla vs. Mothra in 1992, and also Godzilla vs. Space Godzilla in 1994. So the 1992 film, Godzilla vs. Mothra, portrays Gothra as a guardian of the Earth who presided over an advanced civilization over 12,000 years ago. When the civilization created a device designed to control the Earth's climate, the Earth responded by creating the Black Mothra, Batra, which Mothra defeated, but not before the civilization was wiped out. Mothra's egg is later discovered in 1993 on Infant Island by the Marutomo Real Estate Agency, which seeks to exploit it and Mothra's priestesses for profit. The egg hatches during a fight between Godzilla and a resurrected Batra, and the larva later attacks Tokyo in order to save its priestesses. Mothra forms a cocoon around the National Diet Building, attains its adult form, then briefly fights Batra before joining forces with him in order to fight Godzilla. Batra dies in the attempt, and Mothra pledges to fulfill Batra's role in preventing a meteorite from devastating the Earth in 1999. In Godzilla vs. Space Godzilla, Mothra becomes aware of Space Godzilla's advance towards Earth and sends her priestesses to warn Earth of his arrival. Now, I figure what they mean by these priestesses, from little bits of film that I've seen with Mothra, they'll usually be these twins that Mothra speaks through, these twin humans. And the this new film did honor that. You don't see the two twins together, but you do get the indication that there are these twin girls. Played by, I think it's Shang Zihi. I never know how to say her name, but she was in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Also, Rush Hour 2, you would have seen her, but she is in this film and did a very good job. I think she has now learned to speak English pretty fluently, because she's fully acting in English. Anyways, there is a Rebirth of Mothra trilogy from 1996 to 1998. Rebirth of Mothra is separate from the Heisei continuity and portrays Mothra as the last remaining member of a species of giant moths who guard the Elias civilization. This civilization was destroyed millions of years ago by the dragon Dez Ghidorah, whom Mothra defeated. Mothra lays an egg in modern times, but is too weak to fight Dez Ghidorah once it returns. The egg hatches, and the new Mothra, named Mothra Leo, goes to protect his mother, but sadly, Mothra is killed by Dez Ghidorah, while Leo is still too weak to injure the dragon. Leo manages to kill Dez Ghidorah after maturing. And they made a few other ones like that, and Mothra did come back. They have the Millennium films from 2001 to 2004. I think I've seen one of the Godzilla movies in, like, 2000. I think they made one, or... But I do remember going when there was in American theaters. But I want to move on to Ghidorah, who shows up in the Showa era, which is 1964 to 1973. Excuse me. In its debut film, Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, Ghidorah is portrayed as an ancient extraterrestrial entity responsible for the destruction of the Venusian civilization 5,000 years before the film's events. Its attempt to destroy Earth is thwarted by the combined efforts of Godzilla, Rodan, and Mothra. And we talked about this just a little bit before. And they have some subsequent films. Generally, Ghidorah has been an alien three-headed dragon. In the Heisei era... you have Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah from 1991, and there's the creature is re-envisioned as a trio of diminutive genetically engineered creatures called Dorats, owned by a group of humans from the 23rd century, known as the Equal Environment Earth Union, a group dedicated to equalizing the power of Earth's nations. seeking to stop Japan's global economic dominance in their timeline by transforming the Dorats into King Ghidorah through nuclear exposure. The Earth Unionists plant the Dorats on Lagos Island during the 1954 H-bomb tests there. Prior to doing so, they removed the dinosaur that would ultimately become Godzilla from the island so that King Ghidorah would be able to attack Japan without opposition. In 1992, the Earth Unionists unleash Ghidorah onto Japan, but he is defeated by a recreated Godzilla. The wounded King Ghidorah lies dormant under the sea for 2 centuries before being outfitted with robotic parts by a disillusioned Earth Unionist and sent back to 1992 as Mecha King Ghidorah in order to stop Godzilla's rampage. And they come up with different versions of their monsters frequently. And so now, with the rights here with Legendary Pictures, we've got Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and we get an appearance by Rodan, Ghidorah, and Mothra, and probably some other monsters that may have been in some previous films that I'm not familiar with. This film did connect itself to Kong Skull Island, and you can see it in some text on some computer screens. It is mentioned, and there is definitely some old ancient artwork that depicts Godzilla fighting King Kong, so we know that is coming. But overall, this film, now the critics are being kind of harsh, but so far the audiences are really enjoying this, and I had a good time with it. The one criticism I definitely would bring is something I had with the 2014 Godzilla. I felt like it spent too much time with humans, and the monsters were fighting somewhere in the background, and we didn't really get that. When you go to a Godzilla movie, you want to see monsters fighting, right? That's what you go for, giant monsters fighting. And this movie, we'd get a little glimpses of the monsters fighting, but then we'd get back down to see what the humans were doing. Although the humans were a lot more interesting, I think, than the forgettable ones that we saw really in the 2014 film. Although we do have a couple of returning characters, one of them, of course, played by Ken Watanabe. He's like Dr. Sirazwa. I can never get these names right, but we do have him back, and that's great because Ken Watanabe is always interesting to watch, even when he doesn't have a very big part, like in Batman Begins when he was the other Ra's al Ghul, or Ra's al Ghul, whichever one you're going to go with, but it's supposed to be Ra's al Ghul. So when we see him as the Asian version before, you know, we find out later that Liam Neeson actually is the real Ra's al Ghul. So, you know, everything he does, he's just great in, really. So him being in there, we get to see a family that there's Monarch, which I don't know if that was introduced in the Kong movie, but Monarch is this organization, which I think was introduced in the 2014 movie, where, of course, these Titans, as they're now calling them, they're trying to monitor the Titans and trying to figure things out. I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but somebody has an interesting moment that reminds me of a freshman senator. We'll just say that, just as crazy as that sort of a thing. But there are themes that are continued with nature trying to balance and the balance being brought about by these Titans, mainly with Godzilla. He is the balance of nature. And when depicted in Godzilla films, sometimes he's sort of villainous, sometimes he's the hero. He's always that somewhere in between. He's always got his own agenda. And I did like a video I saw looking at the 2014 Godzilla movie, that Godzilla is being depicted now as like this almost aged retired samurai who's now been called back to active service, and he seems a little worn, but he's got things to do. But he manages to have personality, and now we can actually get some more facial expressions because now he's a computer generated, but still very believable. And I do like the design of Godzilla in these newer films, that he does resemble some of the classic film, but yet maybe a bit more believable. The funny thing about this is you could almost have a drinking game for it. Millie Bobby Brown, of course, having a role. You might know her from Stranger Things as playing Eleven. But you could make a drinking game on how many times she swears, dropping mainly S-bombs. You could be drunk within the first 10 minutes of the game because she burns bacon and has a tirade of S-bombs. Which is, you know, a very human thing to do. I'm sure many people have done that before, but as my wife has said, like, she does not like to hear kids cussing it, you know, but there also is the obligatory, hey, it's PG-13 if we only drop an F-bomb once. And so they do manage to hit it once, although I guess it doesn't count when you can flip somebody the bird, but even though we know it means an F-bomb, it's not an actual F-bomb, so you can still drop an F-bomb and flip the bird. So, parents, be cautioned. if you're concerned about that, yes, my gosh, there was a lot of language in this. My goodness. But overall, very enjoyable. I don't want to give away any major plot points, but it revolves around, of course, Ghidorah being an alien and not part of the Earth balance, and some humans, of course, making a bad decision to release Ghidorah onto the Earth and causing wide destruction all across the Earth. There's a few things that are a little stretch of belief, like how could a young girl escape from this armed facility of the environmental terrorist group, which we kind of mentioned there was like a group in the Ghidorah movies that was, you know, had released Ghidorah before. That's kind of what we got going on. It was very much a salute to that. And, of course, King Ghidorah establishes like a kingship and wants to control the Titans. And so the real fight of this is these two rivals, Godzilla and King Ghidorah, on fighting who will be the master of these monsters. And one being a bit more benevolent than the other. All right. So Godzilla, despite the destruction he can cause, is a bit more benevolent than Ghidorah. And we do have some really interesting bits with Mothra. They did a great job animating Mothra to be this ethereal being. Mothra was really fantastic. It almost would bring a tear to your eye. It was very beautiful to look at Mothra when she'd fly in. And then, of course, she gets involved in the battle with Ghidorah and Rodan and trying to help Godzilla at the end of the film. But they do give a lot to Rodan and Ghidorah and Mothra and bring them in as viable threats to the planet. Overall, though, this was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I think everybody in the audience that I was with seemed to be having a good time and enjoying it, because you come to a Godzilla, you want to see giant monsters in epic battles, and that's pretty much what we got. Without some of the silliness of some of the old Japanese within a suit, where the Godzilla started getting a little bit silly at one point before they rebooted him again, and he was a bit more villainous. You know, he's kind of gone back and forth on these different eras on whether he's kind of villainous, whether he's pure hero, or whether he's a mixture of both. And in this, he seems to be, they want him to be more heroic, but he can't help. He does cause some destruction when he shows up, but he often is coming up trying to help the humans. And there is even a great moment, because Ken Watanabe's character says, you know, Godzilla tends to bring forth redemptive qualities. And there is a redemptive thing. There's the family that we're going to focus on in there. Their son died during the events in San Francisco of the 2014 film. And there's almost an apology from Godzilla to him. Like, he kind of understands. And there's kind of this eye-to-eye look that they have. And Godzilla, the expression kind of changes, like, I understand. And I didn't mean for your son to die. And I'm sorry, but I have a job to do. You know, that kind of thing. But I really did enjoy this film, and I do recommend you go and check it out. I mean, I know it's not a Disney film, but it is a lot of fun, unless you just absolutely don't like Godzilla movies.
Thank you for listening to the Neverland Podcast.
We invite you back next week for more fun and adventure.
Until then, remember to keep a pixie in your pocket.
It's that young at heart, positive attitude that you can share with others.
And remember to visit our website at neverlandpodcast.com.
There you can find links to our news page, our shop,
our contact page, where you can easily send an email to podcast@neverlandpodcast.com.
You can also find our Neverlanders page, where you can find out how to become an official Lost Boy or Pixie, because girls are too clever to get lost.
Become a real Neverlander.
Please feel free to leave us a voicemail at 816-226-6492.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NeverlandPCast.
And like our Neverland Podcast fan page on Facebook.
We also have a group on Facebook for you to join.
We also appreciate your support to keep the Neverland Podcast up and running.
Visit patreon.com/neverlandpodcast to donate to keeping the pixie dust alive.
Copyright content featured on the Neverland Podcast is copyright of their respective creators and used under fair use license.
All original content is copyright of Blue Band Productions, and a very special thanks to Yeehaw Bob Jackson at yeehawbob.com for our new ending music.
God bless!
Yeah! Hello, everybody, this is Yeehaw Bob Jackson. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Neverland Podcast, it's true. Neverland Podcast, we love you.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.